The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
History. Anyway, you'll see some of that stuff in here. All right, let's pray and then we'll start. Dear Father, I pray that you'll remove me, get me out of the way. I thank you for the cross. I thank you for this conference, and I thank you for these attendees, and I pray that you'll superintend the words and the discussions today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Several years ago, I decided to put our geometry textbooks on the shelf and teach strictly from Euclid's Elements. As it turns out, there are several really good reasons to do this, and I hope to convince you of some of those today. To be honest, though, I didn't switch for any of those really good reasons. Instead, I did it for two pretty poor ones. First, I was bored with all those geometry textbooks. Some publishers tried to pretty up the books. Others tried to connect geometry to the real world by profiling people who use it in their everyday work. It seemed to me we were dumbing down the topic just to make it more attractive to the average high school student, and it wasn't working. Why can't geometry be beautiful just because it is? Here is Raphael's The School of Athens. Notice the lower right-hand corner. A blow-up of this corner is also the cover of the translation of Euclid that we use. The old bald guy is obviously Euclid, and he's the only guy in the painting surrounded by middle school students. And they even look interested. The second reason I switched was because no one told me not to. I know. Really? My headmaster either trusted me a lot, or since he wasn't a math guy, he didn't really know what I was planning to do. So he let me go ahead and try it. He was a brave guy. Later, after I had already taught a course or two, several other math teachers told me they wouldn't attempt to teach Euclid because they thought it would be beyond their students' abilities to understand, or because they thought it would not hold their students' interests. A lot of old myths about the boring Euclid. Neither fear has been true. I need to confess one more sin. I'll probably confess more before we're done. That very first year, I was teaching Euclid without having previously studied it myself. This meant I had to read and digest Euclid at least one class period ahead of my students. This is like a literature teacher reading Pride and Prejudice for the first time just ahead of her students. While this might make for a very fresh view of the material, and the good teacher may be able to convey her enthusiasm for the novel, the teacher who has spent more time in the text will be able to glean more and therefore share more from the text. In fact, my literature teachers tell me you need to know how Pride and Prejudice ends in order to teach it well. You need to know where the foreshadowing is. I have found the same true for Euclid. Of course, I didn't know that during the first year. Because of that, my geometry students during that first year certainly received a poorer introduction to Euclid's mind than do my current students. I only hope those first-year students will forgive me. I've come to the opinion that even this stunted view into Euclid's thoughts was superior to a more complete view into a modern geometry textbook. In fact, recently, one of our graduates who was in that first Euclidean class, by the way, it was our valedictorian, told me that his highest mathematics scores on his college entrance exams, and we're not supposed to talk about those here, were in geometrical reasoning. He felt Euclid gave him a good spatial perspective. I have two goals today. First, I would like to convince any of you geometry teachers that Euclid is better than modern geometry textbooks. And not because of any misplaced loyalty to anything and everything classical. If I succeed in that, I want to show you how you might implement the study of Euclid in your classroom. By doing so, I hope your first Euclidean geometry class will exceed mine in their comprehension of and affection for the subject. But like I said earlier, I also have a real passion for the non-mathematically oriented teacher. I really hope to convince some of you today of the beauty and connectedness of the Euclid's Elements to other non-mathematical subjects. But to do this, I need to lay some groundwork. Some of you, maybe even many of you, would agree that mathematics is an important subject for our students to learn. Probably everybody in here. But not everyone believes mathematics is all that important. Just ask your average high school student. Certainly a small handful of mathematically oriented students will gush over the idea, but that's a small percentage, usually 10 to 20, 30%. And these go on to be engineers or science majors in college. And then you have your overachievers. Those students will point out the need to take math courses in order to be able to get into the best colleges. However, beyond that, well, not really. Many parents will say, well, I used to think math was really not that important when I was in school, but now that I'm all grown up, I have a better view. After all, the best jobs nowadays go to people who are good at math, and I want my kid to have the best chance at success, whatever that means. It may surprise you to note, however, that high school students are not the only ones who would do away with compulsory mathematics courses. Andrew Hacker, in a New York Times op-ed, and Nicholson Baker in a similar article in Harper's Magazine, by the way, I understand this slide can be a little distracting, so that's not a real New York Times paper on the left side, but I liked it, so I included it. Andrew Hacker in the New York Times and Nicholson Baker in the Harper's Magazine believe higher level mathematics education, that is Algebra 2 or higher, should be limited to those who show aptitude for it and should not be used as a litmus test for getting into college. While in the minority, these writers are not alone. To be fair, Hacker and Baker have some good points. For example, they point out that prior to 1958, only about 25% of high school students took Algebra 2 or higher. They neglect, of course, to mention that most high school students of those generations did not go on to university. Some of their strongest arguments come when they point out that our current infatuation with higher level mathematics education in high school is a result of a Cold War battle with the Soviets. The West began emphasizing mathematics, particularly calculus, as the ultimate high school math course shortly after Sputnik was launched. Hacker and Baker argue that mathematics is only needed by those going on to work in scientific, engineering, or other technical fields. While these arguments may hold some validity, they are, in my opinion, only from a utilitarian standpoint. The root of the issue is not how useful mathematics is to an individual, or even to a society at large, but rather what good education in mathematical thought can do to develop the ability to think. Ultimately, I believe Hacker and Baker's arguments are less an indictment on why we teach mathematics and more an indictment on how we teach mathematics. The way we currently approach mathematics education in the U.S. only appeals to those types of individuals with a bent toward mathematics anyway. Our methodology, in particular, our insistence on disconnecting the study of mathematics from its historical development and from its direct impact on the humanities, ignores vast swaths of our high school population. Hacker admits that apparently other educational models are doing a better job at getting their students to understand mathematics. He cites studies of students in Finland, South Korea, and Canada, indicating they score better on mathematics tests. He believes it's their perseverance, not their pedagogy, that sets them apart. I know what you're thinking. I understand Korea, but Canada? Can he be so sure it's not the way they teach mathematics that makes their students outperform ours? Couldn't the problem cited by Baker and Hacker really be more indicative of a failed educational system than the fact that some really smart people just don't get math? Now, I get this a lot. Many of you probably do, too. People who consider themselves well-educated will say something like, I never really got math. To me, that's like saying some really smart people just can't read or write. While it may be true that there are people who do not read or write and could, and even do them well, the reason these people cannot is more a function of how they have been taught, or rather, how they have not been taught. The root of the problem is how our culture looks at mathematics in general. You see, in the end, I don't agree with Hacker or Baker, but I also don't agree with those well-meaning parents who want their children to learn mathematics because the jobs go to those with a math background. I even disagree with those who think mathematics should be thought of as a subject that is somehow separate and distinct from other subjects. The word mathematics comes from the Greek word mathema, which means that which is learnt. In that sense, everything we study is mathematics. Mathematics teaches us how to think rationally, which is, curiously, a mathematical term, the ratio of two whole numbers. Above the entrance to his academy, Plato supposedly put the words, "Let no man ignorant of geometry enter here." You see, Plato and Aristotle, and most of the ancient Greeks, believed in the importance of mathematics for anyone seeking a leadership role in their society. They taught what would later come to be called the seven liberal arts, which were ultimately codified by the medievalists as grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, or as most classical schools now call them, the trivium and those other things. Oh, and music. The trivium, of course, refers to the language arts. At this conference, you can attend almost any other lecture and hear all you need to know about the trivium. With the exception of music, you're hard-pressed here to hear more than a few topics that discuss the last four, or the quadrivium, referred to as the mathematical arts. Yes, we like music, but do we connect it to the trivium through the mathematical arts? I want to be clear here. I mean to take us to task. I mean to take myself to task. Our Protestant classical Christian school movement, which started with Doug Wilson's book, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning, has done a great job recovering the trivium. However, we, myself included, have done a less than remarkable job, I think, recovering the other lost tools, namely the quadrivium. Why? Maybe it's because, unlike the verbal arts, we somehow don't think the mathematical pedagogy in the United States is broken, because it works. But I would argue that it only works for those select few, the 10, 20, or 30%. Like Wilson, I want to call us to recover these other lost tools of learning. Let's spend a moment delving a little more deeply into the medievalists' mathematical teaching methodology. It was those medievalists, after all, who codified the seven liberal arts. They believed that every voting citizen should be trained in the trivium. However, they further believed that leaders should receive further training in the quadrivium. In fact, many argued that the best reason for the trivium was to prepare students to comprehend the quadrivium. They believed that arithmetic was the study of number. By the time of the Middle Ages, Arabic numerals were known. However, most of number theory was still bound up in geometry. In fact, much of Euclid's Elements uses line segments to discuss number theory. Today, arithmetic is the domain of the primary teacher. However, we make a mistake, I think, when we view her job as teaching the grammar of mathematics. It is fundamentally different in that this is where students are first introduced to comparisons. This side equals that side. These numbers represent this many things. If I break them up, these numbers of things become a much larger number of things. Next, the medievalists would have defined geometry as the study of numbers in two- and three-dimensional space. This will not surprise anyone who has taken a high school geometry course. However, it may surprise you to find that geometry textbooks of that period, that is, Euclid's Elements, did not contain numbers the way we use them today. When students begin to ask why mathematics works, they are almost ready for geometry. Again, it's more than just the logic of mathematics. However, it has as its heart the study of logic, and most students will recognize their logic class here. Third, astronomy was the study of number moving in two- and three-dimensional space. Today, the study of physics covers most of what would have been considered astronomy. However, we're increasingly finding that chemistry and even biology depend upon number. This is not the rhetoric of mathematics, but strong rhetorical skills are certainly necessary to understand the deepest meanings in how and why the creation works. Finally, music was the study of all three: arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy, moving beautifully. From the Middle Ages, we get the expression, the music of the heavenly spheres. Perhaps music, or harmony, should really be considered the culmination of the previous six vias. After all, we appreciate beauty more when we have attempted the beautiful. Of course, the medieval mathematics professor meant something radically different by the term heavenly spheres than we moderns do. We immediately think of planets, asteroids, stars, and the like. However, from the time of Aristotle until Galileo, most astronomers believed that all the bodies in the heavens were circles that existed on huge, mostly transparent globes situated concentrically with the Earth in the very center of all the globes. The outermost globe, and I'm going to say this wrong, called the primus mobilis, or prime mover, was given its motion by God. And then its motion was transferred to the inner globes through some type of energy transfer process. This was known as the geocentric, that is, Earth-centered, or geostatic, that it means the Earth does not move, theory. Well, this may sound like a digression from my argument. It is, in fact, crucial to it. You see, Galileo's arguments for a sun-centered or heliocentric model did not really carry the day, even among secular scientists, until Kepler, Descartes, and Newton provided the mathematical models showing that the planets moved in elliptical, not circular, orbits around the sun. A good course on analytic geometry, which comprises much of what we normally call algebra 2, should cover this. You'll be hard-pressed, however, to find a mathematical textbook in the U.S. that even refers to this idea, much less works problems related to it. This is a major connection between what students study in high school history and their theology courses and what should be taught in math classes. This issue is central to the most significant moment in the science-religion debate, and we as a culture ignore it. What we are missing today is the purpose behind the study of mathematics. Our great technological advances, the great usefulness of mathematics in achieving those advances, and the better job opportunities for those with good mathematical skills are byproducts of mathematics, not reasons for studying mathematics. Mathematics done right teaches us how to think, how not to be wrong, how to take a logical argument to its logical conclusion. As such, people who have been properly trained in mathematical reasoning are better at making logical arguments, are better at drawing logical conclusions, and are better at making good decisions than they would have been without the training. Like most of you, I come from a pedagogy, or a philosophy of teaching, that attempts to utilize the subject of logic. Mathematics, at its heart, is an attempt, a really good attempt, at using logic to describe our world. Over the centuries, mathematicians have developed shorthand notations to standardize ways to communicate their ideas. For example, the Latin word for and is et. Over time, the E fell away, leaving just the T, from which we now have the plus sign. Therefore, 2 et 2 became 2 plus 2. In fairness to both Baker and Hacker, I agree with many other points. However, Hacker in particular appears to want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I know that's a bad metaphor. They want to eliminate higher-level mathematics altogether, particularly algebra, as a college entrance requirement. His main reason is that too many people fail it. And again, I believe that's because we're teaching mathematics incorrectly. Mathematics and mathematical thinking are important, and we as a culture are doing a really lousy job handing down this language and these skills to our children. How do we fix it? Here I would refer you to a book by my friends Ravi Jain and Kevin Clark entitled The Liberal Arts Tradition, a Philosophy of Christian Classical Education. In it, Jane and Clark lay out an idea to connect mathematics and science education to the narratives or stories behind their development. Many others have tried this, mostly in the field of the history of mathematics or science. Most have done a good job and are great references on how to connect mathematics instructions to its historical roots. At his classical school in Orlando, Ravi Jain has taken it one step further by teaching the stories behind the creations of the calculus and the physics to his 11th and 12th grade students in his calculus and physics courses. By doing so, he stretches over 2 years what most high school courses attempt to cover in 1 year. But also by doing so, he's created an environment where his students excel, connecting what they're studying in mathematics to what they're studying in history and the humanities. Ravi's students routinely do well on the AP Physics and Calculus test, not necessarily because he focuses on those tests, but because his students spend so much time making connections between mathematics and what they're learning in other classes. This is my attempt to do something similar with geometry. There are numerous reasons why we should study Euclid in lieu of modern geometry texts. Euclid is an important primary source in the development of thought. Euclid has been the educational bedrock of some of history's most influential thinkers, from Plato to Lincoln and others. It seems to me that most mathematics students are becoming good accountants, but not necessarily good mathematicians. By that, I mean they can find the right answer if they have all the inputs and have been taught all the formulas and the manipulation skills required to get to that answer. A mathematician is something altogether different, I think. A mathematician is someone who sees things in a certain way and develops patterns to reason a path to a solution. The visual means thinking about space, however one represents space in one's head. A bat may be blind, but certainly has a wonderful understanding of space. I think a bat would be capable of geometry if it had the intelligence. So it's not the eyes so much. The word visual for me means something that goes on in the brain and has direct contact with space and distance in space. Douglas Hofstadter. Mathematics should teach our students a different way of seeing, a different way of knowing, and a different way of deciding when a problem is solved. Right now, Euclid may be our only real chance in secondary school to push our students to develop real mathematical reasoning skills. Next, Euclid makes a better connection to the study of history. Oh, I apologize for my slides. They look better on my computer, but my computer doesn't hook up. René Descartes first united Greek geometry and Arabic algebra with his coordinate system, formerly referred to as the Cartesian coordinate plane, but more often called the XY plot. Algebra comes from the word al-jabr, which you can't see there, meaning completion or restoration. There it is. We believe it was first used by the Arabic mathematician Al-Khwarizmi with the word muqabala, meaning to balance. At its heart, algebra means to restore by balancing. Whatever we do to one side of the equation, we must do to the other side also. Geometry comes from the Greek words geo, meaning earth, and meter, meaning measurement, literally earth measurement. The result of this marriage is what we call today analytic geometry, which most textbook publishers ham-handedly clump into Algebra 2, along with a lot of other concepts. Graphical analysis gives us much more powerful tools to describe and manipulate geometric objects. By first studying Euclid, students will get a better understanding of how Descartes' invention revolutionized the way we see the world. Not only that, students should notice that Descartes' invention formed a bridge between East and West, between Arabic and Greek, and finally between Islam and Christianity. If mathematics has done that in the past, might not mathematics do that again in the future? If we follow Hacker and Baker's advice, large numbers of students will be denied the opportunity to make this connection between algebra and geometry. They will not be able to see how circles and ellipses can be drawn, converted to a formula, and analyzed. They'll miss the opportunity to study in depth how Kepler's discovery that planets orbit the sun in elliptical, not circular orbits, finally provided the proof for Copernicus's and Galileo's ideas. History majors will miss the nuance that Galileo really did not have good proof of his theory until Kepler's insight. Literature majors will have a richer understanding of Dante's Inferno. You see, Galileo's first paper as a young mathematician concerned the shape and location of Dante's circles of hell. Euclid also makes a better connection to the humanities. Euclid starts with 23 definitions, 5 postulates, and 5 common notions. I spend an entire class period on these. For example, I tell them there are X number of perfect circles in the room and ask them to find them. They look around the room for a long time, coming up with several. Nothing they point to is a perfect circle. It takes a while and a lot of discussion for them to realize that anybody see where I'm going with this? How many perfect circles are in this room? How many people are in this room? The only perfect circles in the room are the ones inside each of our heads. All the things we draw are just representations of what's in our head. Euclid's first common notion states, things which are equal to the same thing are also equal to one another. In modern mathematical terms, we would say, if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. In logic, this is a valid syllogism of the form AAA1. In my classes, we use Euclid's first common notion nearly every class period. Students soon have it memorized. Every year in February, the entire upper school takes a day off from normal classes to watch and discuss a film. One year we watched Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis in the title role. During that film, President Lincoln, who was, by the way, an avid student of Euclid, quotes the first common notion in trying to make a point about the equality of the races. My ninth grade geometry students quoted it with him. They were able to connect a mathematical idea to the idea of racial equality. But maybe the next one's better. For 2 years now, my students have also connected Euclid's first common notion to a theological idea. Without prompting, and quite independently, two students in 2 separate history classes, I know, history class, brought this up and presented with a theological idea that Jesus is fully God and Jesus is fully man, yet man somehow is not fully God. From there, the classes had great discussions on whether this fundamental mathematical idea is flawed or whether the theological idea is flawed. Anybody want to tell me the answer? Brave souls. In the end, we're able to show that the two statements are not logically equivalent. There you go. The second statement suffers from the fallacy of the illicit major. The statement, all Jesus is man, makes a statement about all of Jesus, not about all men. So to say that all men are God is making a statement about all men. A good counterexample, I think this is right out of the logic textbook that Jim Nance writes. All mothers are parents, all mothers are women, therefore all women are parents. The point is that Euclid makes a better connection to the study of logic. Euclid is, of course, one long logical argument utilizing many of the aspects of logic studied by our students. In fact, one could argue that Euclid is the first, best, and most complete example of a lengthy logical argument in the history of man. As such, studying Euclid reinforces what we teach in our middle school logic course. Book 1 in particular is a great example of a lengthy logical argument all focused on one goal, the Pythagorean formula. Which brings me to my last point. Euclid makes a better connection to the historical development of mathematics and scientific thought. Euclid's fifth postulate, commonly called the parallel postulate, was also the most awkward and cumbersome of his postulates. That if a straight line falling on 2 straight lines make the interior angles on the same side less than 2 right angles, the 2 straight lines, if produced indefinitely, meet on that side on which the angles are less than 2 right angles. From the very first day, the students recognize how awkward this is. Compare it to the simplicity of the other 4 postulates, the first 4. These postulates allow me to actually draw straight lines as opposed to just think about them, to draw circles and right angles, and connect them, these to the abstract ideas from the definitions. Euclid himself appears to dislike the parallel postulate, using it only when absolutely necessary. In fact, listen closely. I tell the students on the very first day, and then again later on, that this parallel postulate will bite them by the end of the semester. Remember that. In the early 1800s, mathematicians decided to remove this postulate and tried to develop other logical forms of geometry. This movement led to several forms of non-Euclidean geometry, including absolute geometry and affine geometry. These new geometries may be viewed as subsets or at least tangents of Euclid's, and they, in turn, eventually led, I'm told, to Einstein's theory of relativity. Finally, most early scientific arguments, such as Galileo's kinematic theorems, were proven geometrically, not algebraically. Galileo's Dialogue of the Two Sciences, where he first formalizes what would later become known as Newtonian physics, velocity, acceleration, etc., were proven using geometrical means. He was writing this dialogue at roughly the same time Descartes was developing his coordinate system, so he never had the chance to use Descartes' method. Both Galileo and Newton organized and presented their ideas in definition, postulate, proposition format, just like Euclid. Of course, there are arguments against teaching Euclid. Some say it's boring. However, that has not been my experience. My students like the idea of learning something through a different lens than their friends in other schools. My Euclid class is traditionally my most popular math class. One of the reasons it's so popular are the constructions. We actually construct squares on the sides of right triangles to prove the Pythagorean formula. Some may say it's too difficult. However, we in the classical Christian school movement know our students are capable of more than we thought. Maybe the most serious argument is that it does not teach things that will be needed in following classes. Let me show you how I address this by walking you through how I teach Euclid. The elements are broken up into 13 books. I teach all of Book 1 and selections from Books 2, 3, 4, and 6. We use our compasses and our straight edges nearly every day. They whine if I tell them we're not using them. Many modern geometry texts use these tools a little, and usually only late in the course. Make sure you buy the best compasses. Cheap compasses don't last past the first week of school. I also look for good quality straight edges, not rulers, because I don't want the students to attempt to use the unit measurements. It's imperative that you purchase a good translation of Euclid. The very best is Thomas Heath's. Of these, purchase Green Lion Press's tradition. This is printed on heavy paper, and it's rugged. Also, when a proposition requires you to turn the page, the drawing is repeated on the next page. This means you don't have to flip back and forth. This edition comes in hardback and paperback. I purchased the hardback edition for myself. However, I have each student purchase the paperback for him or herself, and this is theirs to keep. In addition, I recently discovered a question guide to Book 1 by Dana Densmore. Although I haven't had yet occasion to use it in class, I intend to glean heavily from it next semester. I had them take notes in the text, writing things that will connect Euclid's terminology to modern geometry. I tell them when they get to college, this will be one of the textbooks on their bookshelf. I also tell them when a member of the opposite sex sees it and says, "That's so cool," they should ask them to marry you. Book 1, Proposition 4 proves side angle side, and congruent parts of congruent triangles are congruent, or SAS and CPCTC. But Euclid never uses these expressions. I tell the students what they are, have them annotated in Euclid like I did, and we refer to them as such from then on. But they know we're talking about Euclid 1-4. In your booklet, so you don't have to write these down, in your booklet, I have included a translation of Euclid into modern geometrical terms. I thought that was more useful than my outline blown up over two pages. I also recommend the website shown here, which is in your notes. I built a smart board for less than $250 using two Wii remotes and an overhead projector. Cool. Ask me how to do it. It's on a TED Talk. I'm able to project this website and have my students use it. In fact, we alternate. I teach the really tough propositions and constructions. However, I have them take turns teaching the other ones. Everybody, even the weakest students, can find a place to shine while using Euclid. Book one is primarily concerned with triangles. I spend the entire first semester on book one alone. It culminates in a proof of the Pythagorean theorem. This is proved entirely by geometric means. But after understanding the method, we research other methods of proving this important theorem. On the way, book one covers side angle side, side side side, angle side angle, CPCTC, equilateral isosceles, acute and obtuse triangles, triangle congruence, bisections of lines and angles, vertical angles, parallel lines, perpendicular lines, parallelograms, and a lot of really great constructions. Since we teach geometry after Algebra 1, we also bring in related problems from algebra to keep them familiar with the coordinate plane. I use the ExamView program to generate problems for homework as well as in-class written tests. I give an oral test. I'll talk about that in a minute. And the written test is for the students who aren't out in the hall with me taking the oral test, just to keep them busy. However, if you decide to teach geometry before algebra, you can probably still find some interesting problems for students to work on to engage their minds in thinking mathematically. After finishing book one, we spend about 2 weeks working all sorts of problems related to the Pythagorean formula, culminating in the study of circles on the Cartesian plane, thereby introducing them to analytic geometry. By the end of the semester, the students are very comfortable with the Pythagorean formula. So I give them this problem. I hope this works. Slipped into a homework set. I give them the distance from Libreville, Gabon to Lerida, Colombia, and note that both are on the equator. Then I give them the distance from Cagliari, Italy, directly south to Libreville. Finally, I ask them for the distance from Lerida, Colombia to Cagliari, Italy. At some point, depending on the class, I tell them that I will cancel the final exam that semester if everyone gets this question correct. Anybody want to tell me why this doesn't work? Yes, the non-math. You're going to tell me.
Oh, because
it's a trick question. Euclid's parallel postulate only works on plane geometry, not spherical geometry. Oh, there you go. There you go. Great. Since the Pythagorean formula is based in plane geometry, it doesn't work. My students get really mad, but they get the point. This last year, I had two really bright students, so I had to wait until the day they actually came in. Usually, I let them work on it overnight for homework. And I tell them the day before, the class period before, that I might drop the exam. This last class period, I had to wait until that class period to tell them that. And as soon as I announced that, one of the two smart, really, really smart students said, "Oh, there's a trick here." In the second semester, I teach books 2 through 6, which cover rectangles, circles, arcs, tangents, secants, chords, arc length, central angles, inscribed angles and ratio, regular polyhedra, proportionality. We also cover the golden ratio. We do not just discuss the golden ratio, nor do we simply work mathematical models related to it. We actually construct the golden rectangle, which is necessary to build a pentagon. You saw it right away. This, in turn, is necessary to construct one of the 5 Platonic solids. The ancients believed the golden ratio was the essence of beauty. I'll leave that up to you. Our study in Euclid culminates... Oops, I'm getting ahead. I'm sorry. Oh, no, I'm right. Our study in Euclid culminates in the students constructing the 5 Platonic solids with a discussion on why there can only be 5. Their last exercise in Euclid is to convince me that their constructions, they make them out of cardboard, Their last exercise is to convince me that their constructions are the best representations of Plato's five solids. Because Plato thought his five solids represented the five elements, earth, water, air, fire, and the quintessence, or fifth element. This last year's winner was the quietest student I've ever taught. And when she got up, it was kind of a Harry Potter kind of thing. She had the final thing being that stone from Harry Potter coming out of the... She had them nested. It was really beautiful. And she made it kind of this kind of quirky, kind of mythical discussion. She actually won hands down. Everybody else had to throw in the towel. I then introduced the students to the ideas of geometry, reflection, and translations by working back through some of Euclid's propositions using those tools as shortcuts. If time permits, I'll introduce students to trigonometry somewhere in the fourth quarter. Euclid proves a rich medium in our rich medium to reawaken in our students a love for patterns. It makes great connections between mathematics and how it was developed, as well as connections between mathematics and how we live our lives. Of course, nothing can compare to or replace the enthusiasm and knowledge of a teacher teaching these ideas. I'm retired Navy, and I had a boss once in the Navy who said, if you ain't having fun, you ain't doing it right. That don't mean you're always having fun, it's just that you messed up. Of course, it was the Navy, he didn't use those exact words. With that in mind, I leave you with these final thoughts from my favorite geometer, H.S.M. Coxeter. The ability to study, grasp, and master topics in mathematics resembles in some ways the ability to swim or to ride a bicycle, each of which is, in a static sense, impossible of achievement. There's a trick to it, and strong motivation is needed to learn the trick. Perhaps one difference is that children seldom encounter oppressive, authoritarian discipline in connection with the technique of riding a bicycle. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I don't know what time, how are we doing? Got plenty of time. Well, actually, there's nobody coming after me, so if you need to leave, leave. You won't insult me. But if you have any questions that everybody could glean from, I'd love to hear from you. Yes, ma'am.
What are some texts or sources you recommend on
the history of the major players? The book I use the most for that sort of thing is The History of Mathematics by a guy named Victor Katz, K-A-T-Z. I don't know if it's the best, it just happened to be the one I put my hands on. I think the best book overall for all of that, let me see if I've got it on my list here, is, thought I had it. Oh, Beauty for Truth's Sake by Stratford Caldicott. Beauty for Truth's Sake by Stratford Caldicott, C-A-L-D-E-C-O-T-T. There's another book out there, James Nichols' book. Does anybody know the title of it? Yeah, that's a good book. Kind of dense, I think, and Caldicott's book, I think, is beautiful. Actually, the teachers and I are reading through it this year. It will connect all the non-math teachers. It will connect it all for your elementary, your grammar school teachers. I highly recommend that book, my best one. I don't know if I answered your question. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, because I teach all the maths. We're small school, you teach everything. I talked to you a little bit about what Ravi Jain does. I've been teaching. I retired from the Navy in 2002, and I've been teaching math, physics, and a little bit of chemistry since then. And I didn't do this. I started this 5 years ago, and really just because I was, ticked off at the modern geometry books. So it's kind of a process, I would say. Certainly, if you take that stuff I put in there in the notes, and if anybody wants a copy of this bibliography, I'll be happy to give it to you, or you can run out and make copies of it if they can. Or if you'll just email me, my email's at the top of the list there in the book, I'll be happy to respond to all of you and I'll send you my slides, I'll send you everything. I've actually got this kind of presentation put in a very long essay form, about 20, 25 pages. So if you want that, I'll even send that to you. I haven't had an overwhelming demand for it. But. Yes, ma'am.
So I'm Canadian.
You're what?
I'm a Canadian.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you math a little bit differently?
I'm sure you do. How do you do it?
Well, we don't separate geometry from the algebra.
Okay. Yes, I wrote.
And I also homeschool, so I teach all math.
You teach all the math. I think it's been a blessing for me. You know, when I retire from the Navy, and I, what do you want to do when you retire? Something that, you know, my older children were in a classical Christian school, had been for several years. So they, I was blessed enough for them to hire me to teach math and physics because I was a nuclear engineer in the Navy. So tell me your question again. Yeah, I think it's been a blessing for me teaching all the maths from seventh grade on up because I really see the development of it. And I think maybe that's the right answer is if all the teachers, if you could somehow move your teachers around so that they're all teaching at some point in their time, they're teaching all the different maths, I think that they'll be able to make those connections. And certainly connecting it to the historical development, I'm a big fan of the scientific revolution. I even talked to Dr. Grant this afternoon about how he would fit it in to his, I don't know if you went to his talk this morning, the revolutions and reformations, and actually he sent me in a completely different direction than I thought about. He sent me to the Napoleonic Wars, which only Dr. Grant could do, I think. I think it's important to read deeply as teachers and to interact a lot with the other faculty. When I put this presentation together, I gave it twice, once to my theology, history, Bible teachers and art teacher, and then once to a big collection of people and got their inputs on it. So it changed considerably based on the standard slide. They mucked it around a lot and it turned out a lot better, I think. So I think what we do in classical education is try to connect things. And that means the teachers have to connect things. I don't know if that answered your question. I tried. Any other questions? Great. You've been a lot of fun. Thanks. Have a great evening.
I'm Susan Smith.
Hi, Susan. I like your last name.